Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll hear from photographer Marvin Christian. Last fall, he donated the William Preston Mayfield collection to Dayton history. Mayfield was the first aerial photographer to fly with the Wright brothers. He was also Marvin Christian's mentor. Up first, this week's news. Officials say a U.S. Air Force Reserve wing that flies troops around the globe will start shutting down on Fridays when civilian furloughs begin at Ohio's largest military base. That's the word at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where around 13,000 civilian employees will be subject to furloughs because of defense budget cuts. Media outlets reported the Air Force Reserve 445th Airlift Wing relies on hundreds of civilian Air Reserve technicians who serve double duty as reserve military personnel to keep nine C-17 Globemaster III cargo jets flying. A study by the nation's leading group of financial risk analysts says medical claims costs could jump an average of 81% for individual policyholders in Ohio under President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. The report released Tuesday by the Society of Actuaries said the increase will be in large part because sicker people will join the individual insurance pool. It does not project medical claim costs for employer plans, which cover most workers. The cost of medical claims is the biggest driver of health insurance premiums. Nationally, claims costs are expected to rise an average 32% per person in the individual health insurance market by 2017. Ohio's insurance director, Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, says the estimates are in line with findings a consulting firm prepared for the state. Following the dismissal of two Miami University students found guilty of tampering with grades, the school says they are taking steps to secure their IT systems. In late October of 2012, a Miami University faculty member contacted IT security and campus police to say she was sure grades she had entered electronically did not match paper records. After a lengthy investigation, it was determined that two students used a device plugged into a port in the back of a computer to record teachers' keystrokes. This allowed them to obtain faculty usernames and passwords. The students changed their grades, and they changed the grades of other students to cover their tracks. Claire Wagner, director of University News and Communications, says they are now taking steps to see this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
We are moving the USB plug-in for the keyboards to the front of the computers where possible so that it's more obvious to see if something else is plugged in there. The IT departments in the academic divisions are aware now to look for these when they do checkups across the classrooms. And we are also investing in some procedures that will let us know if they use another type of keylogger that actually can be slid into a keyboard, apparently.
Wagner says other changes will be made to the university's electronic systems. Faculty members will now get a series of emails when grades are changed to ask them if they meant to change that grade.
There's a certain vigilance that we are seeing that we need to have, and we're really glad that it looks like this was the only set of cases that we could find at Miami.
Both students have signed a statement saying they violated the university's code of conduct and academic integrity policy and accepted dismissal. One student has been charged with six misdemeanor counts related to breaching university computer systems, and the other was charged on three counts. Some better news on the education front. A year ago, SOCHE, the Southwestern Ohio Council for Higher Education, launched an initiative to increase the number of internships in the region. It's called the 20 by 20 Challenge, and its goal is to create 20,000 internships by 2020. After 1 year, SOCHE Executive Director Sean Creighton says the 20 by 20 Challenge has increased the number of internships in Southwest Ohio 7.1%. That's almost 800 new internships, but Creighton says the program is trending in the right direction.
We're still coming out of, you know, an economic crisis with some of the discussions going on around federal funding, and people are a little hesitant. We have a large community of defense contractors and others who are kind of waiting a little bit, but we've certainly been in conversations with them, and they're anxious to start to develop their own programs further. So the 7% growth in the first year, we're really pleased with that.
That increase is in line with national statistics, and Creighton says as they move into year two of the challenge, SOCHE will continue to strengthen and evolve partnerships between the private sector and higher education. Unemployment is still high, and Creighton sees programs like the 20 by 20 Challenge as part of the solution.
When we talk about the fact that we have over 120,000 students studying in this region, that's a remarkable number. People suddenly their eyes open up wide and they recognize, wow, you know, the workforce is here. It's a matter of building that relationship between the companies and the students while the students are in school.
It's reported that 4 out of 10 college graduates never conduct formal job searches when they graduate because their paid internships become full-time career positions. And Creighton says interns who become full-time employees tend to stay longer with the company where they interned. He believes that as more companies realize the benefits of internship programs, the 20 by 20 challenge will meet its goal. Supporters and opponents of gay marriage have been watching what's happening this week as the Supreme Court wrestles with the issue. WISO's Emily McCord spoke with Ohio Public Radio's Bill Cohen about all this, including Ohio law and how it could be affected by the court's decision.
We have a law and we have a constitutional amendment that the voters approved in 2004, and they basically say marriage is between one man and one woman. And we don't have same-sex marriage in Ohio. And the constitutional amendment even says something like, and we're not going to recognize anything that even looks like same-sex marriage, even by another name. So that's what the voters approved in 2004. As I remember it, more than 60% of Ohioans gave their blessing to that constitutional amendment.
Well, how will the Supreme Court's decision, both in the federal level when we're talking about the Defense of Marriage Act and what happens to the California case, how could that impact what's happening here in Ohio?
Well, I think if you are an activist and you want to have same-sex marriage recognized in Ohio, I don't really think, now I'm not a lawyer, of course, here, but I don't really think that the federal ruling is going to have that much of a direct legal impact one way or the other. Let's think this through. If the court rules that the federal and California laws against same-sex marriage are no good, okay, well, that could basically say, well, then Ohio's ban is unconstitutional and it must be dropped. That's fine, but that doesn't automatically give Ohio same-sex marriage. If you wanted to have same-sex marriage, you'd still have to have either the Ohio legislature approve the idea, which is not likely anytime soon, or you have to go to the ballot and get the voters to approve a new constitutional amendment saying we are, in a positive way, having same-sex marriage in Ohio. Now, let's say the Supreme Court rules the other way. Well, Ohio would still be free to have a new constitutional amendment approved by voters that would authorize same-sex marriage. So again, I don't see that the court ruling on the national level would have that big of a legal impact on Ohio. It would still be up to Ohio voters to change the way Ohio sees same-sex marriage.
Now, as I understand it, there is an effort from advocates for same-sex marriage to do just that.
That's right. They've been working for about a year. Of course, their goal is to collect something like 386,000 petition signatures. And if they get that, they could put a same-sex marriage proposal onto the statewide ballot. It would reverse the 2004 ban, and it would not only cancel the ban, it would say, we are authorizing same-sex marriage in Ohio.
You know, 2004 is not that long ago. I wonder when you're talking to advocates, what are they saying about the timing of this?
Well, the gay rights community is basically split on this right now. The activists who are collecting signatures on petitions right now say this is the year to do this. And there are new polls, they say, that show a majority of Ohioans now like the idea of same-sex marriage. There have been two polls recently, one 52% and one 54% Ohioans supporting the idea of same-sex marriage. So these activists say, let's do it. We've got the majority now. But you've got other groups. In fact, two of the established gay rights groups working in Ohio, Human Rights Campaign and Equality Ohio, they say sometimes these polls overestimate how much support there is for same-sex marriage. And they say, why not wait a year or two or three until the polls change even more? And it's very clear you maybe have 55 or 60% of Ohioans supporting same-sex marriage. Why don't we wait a couple, 3 years, build more of a groundswell of support, and then it'll be pretty clear we're going to win. They say if you do it now, it's iffy.
Governor Kasich spoke out on the issue this week. Where does he stand?
Well, he said that he is not for recognizing same-sex marriage, but he said he is for civil unions. But then, just a few hours later, his press secretary said, well, the governor was using the word civil unions in a very informal way. He was just saying that currently he thinks same-sex couples can make legal arrangements that'll transfer money or certain rights to people's partners, and that's the way he was using it. The press secretary said the governor does not support changing the 2004 constitutional amendment to let Ohio recognize legal civil unions. Nothing really shocking, I'd say, out of the governor's office. Nothing like the total 180-degree turnaround by U.S. Senator Rob Portman.
I've been speaking with Bill Cohen with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Glad to.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Last week, we told you about a newly discovered photograph calling into question the Wright brothers' claim to the first in-flight title. The photograph in question was actually a photograph of a photograph, and the controversy brought out local aviation experts to dispute the claim. They contended if Gustav Whitehead, the man some were now giving the first in flight claim to, had successfully flown a plane 2 years before the Wright brothers, and there was photo documentation, why didn't he continue to document subsequent flights? Or, for that matter, why didn't he claim any other successful flights? The aviation experts we spoke with said the Wright brothers' claim was unquestionable, as evidenced by the documentation they provided of their own pursuit of flight. Much of that documentation can be seen clearly in iconic photographs, like that of their first 1903 flight and the first known aerial photograph taken from a Wright brothers' plane while in flight in 1910. The latter photograph was taken by William Preston Mayfield and is now a part of the historical collections located at Dayton History Carillon Park. The Mayfield collection was donated to Dayton History last fall by photographer Marvin Christian. Christian says he's been a photographer since the sixth grade. He always had a camera in his pocket, and he got to know Mayfield by following him around town. Eventually, he started working with Mayfield, then later worked as a photographer in the Air Force. Came back to work with Mayfield again before moving on to have his own commercial studio. We had the honor of speaking with Marvin Christian. First, he tells us about his mentor.
Bill started to work as a photographer for the Dayton Daily News when he was 14 years old, back in about 1909. Paper had sent him over to do some photo work with the Wrights at their laboratory, and Orville took a liking to him and would ask him to come out to Huffman Prairie to photograph their test flights and so forth. And as Bill put it then, the news was too cheap to give him the nickel streetcar fare to go out, so Orville would pick him up in his air-cooled Franklin. And the day they made the first aerial, Bill said that he'd been bugging Orville all summer long to take him up, and finally one day in November, and he said it was colder than hell, Orville said, get in. And so with one arm wrapped around the strut, they took off. Orville pointed at the hangar, and Bill made the shot perfectly squared up on the negative, rushed back to the news, made prints, took it down to the city editor, and the editor refused to run it because there were no people in the picture. But the Air Force Museum and others give him credit for making that first shot. He was very shy, very quiet, wasn't really interested in his own self-promotion. Many times there were interviews set up with him, and he just wouldn't show up. The guy was a genius with the camera. I have no idea how many thousands of his images I've printed, and very few of them need any kind of cropping at all. All of these prints you see here are contact prints, with the exception of this one. And so you can tell just from that how perfectly he's got everything aligned, and a real joy to print. There were a few in there that drove you a little crazy, but he had an eye for it. Equipment varied so much back in those days that if he needed a new lens, he'd buy six and test them himself and keep the best two and send the others back. Most of his equipment had been modified in some manner or another to make his life a little easier and so on. And he just had that critical eye for composure. And it's a very, very unusual collection because the Dayton Daily News, while he was there, allowed him to do all the photo work on the side that he cared to. So it's an interesting collection. You've got the photojournalism from the newspaper, you've got that commercial work, and then he developed this passion for aviation that lasted throughout his career, because the last photograph he made, as far as I know, was some aerials at the Grand American Trap Shoot in Vandalia when he would have been, it would have been like 1972, 73, year or so before he died, still loving to go flying.
Let's talk about his association with the Dayton Daily News from that first picture that they wouldn't print and how his acclaim grew from there.
Well, he was with the news up until the late 30s, and by that point, his commercial efforts had grown so much that the tail was wagging the dog, and he set up a full-time studio. But he also knew so many people. Roscoe Turner, who was internationally famous, an air racer, and quite a character in himself. He and Bill were great buddies, and they flew a lot together, barnstormed around the country. Photographers, as you may know, are notoriously low paid, but Bill was driving Packards in the 1920s, Packard Roadsters. So he was doing very, very well from that standpoint. And it got to the point where he just needed a full-time studio. Open it up, and from that point on, the studio just grew, and I was fortunate enough to put some time in there in the mid-50s. He did a lot of work for the Chamber of Commerce, and that's where the various street scenes and things came into being, or DP&L would install new overhead lighting, and he'd be doing the before and after shots and so forth.
The collection of photographs Marvin Christian donated to Dayton History contain his own and Mayfield's, not only those related to the Wright brothers, but other historical moments in time. So let's talk about some of these photographs.
This photo is of the Newcomb Tavern when it was down on Monument Boulevard, and this is during the 1913 flood when the water had just crested the levee. Now, the water has already been coming in through the back streets and all, but Bill went down, and there was a fire tower there behind the fire station, and he had climbed the tower to make this photograph. And he said when he got down off the tower, the water was over his ankles, and he hustled as fast as he could down to 4th and Main, the Dayton Daily News building. And when he went through the door, the water was over his knees. It was coming up that fast. They were up on the fourth floor, so they did not lose any of the photography or the negatives or any of that business. And they were up there until Governor Cox came in with the National Guard. And Bill said that he got into a boat with a lieutenant, and they went around and they kicked in a couple second-story windows at some photo stores to get more film to continue photographing things. This shot here is of the courthouse and the relief boat. It's probably one of the most famous ones. It's been used by almost everybody in one manner or another. It appears in a lot of books, and it's been on the cover of any number of books, including some that were produced by the Dayton Daily News that I worked with. But it's the relief boat, and remember the promises you made in the attic.
We have a sense of what Mayfield was doing when he was taking these pictures. At the time, did they have an appreciation for what he was doing?
Most people did. There were a lot of photographers at that point. But I think the fact that Bill was such a craftsman, and he always used, the very latest, the finest of equipment, and just had that creative eye long before I ever got to meet him. But talking with other photographers around town, he had their respect, and he actually became a legend in his own time because of the people that he traveled with. In the collection, you'll find pictures of Babe Ruth and Charles Lindbergh, besides the Wright brothers, and there's a letter in here from the White House for photos that he made of Wendell Willkie, and he was a man of the times.
During our conversation, Marvin Christian remembers a call he received from Mayfield in the early 1970s. It was about a year before Mayfield died. He wanted Marvin to take over his photograph collection.
I'd been helping Mayfield out with going to banquets and things of that nature, and he in turn had loaned me some equipment as I needed it, things I didn't have. And Bill called me on a Wednesday night asking if I'd come down and talk to him, and it was about taking over, acquiring the business. My wife had twin girls the next day, and the Grand American Trap Shoot started the following day, so it was quite a picnic there for for a long while. And so that's how I acquired all of it. But Bill would continue to come around to the studio in the evenings or when he was bored. Never saw much of him during the daytime, but I worked a lot of nights at that point. And the roles were kind of reversed because when I started with him, I might be the one on the floor while he was up high on a camera shooting products for Inland or whatnot. And I was doing a lot of work for Top Value at that point. And Bill would be the one sitting on the floor moving dishes or pots and pans or whatever the thing happened to be, and having just the great old time, still chewing on his cigars, and occasionally offering the suggestion, you need a little fill light here or whatnot. But a great experience and quite an interesting individual and a character in its own right.
So what has this collection meant to you over the years?
Oh, boy. From a personal standpoint, it's always been a joy and a pleasure because I like to think that I've looked at everything one time or another. But it's been very a personal thing, and probably one of the best things about having the collection and having shared it over the years in the publications and exhibits is that folks are coming up and telling you stories, personal things from their family or them from themselves, as to how they were involved and how they remembered those days, and a lot of times filling in some gaps in stories and history. I was fortunate because in the sixth grade, I was taking the bus downtown to have clarinet lessons at Howard's. And I'd go to Malone Cameras for film and paper and then to the arcade for hot dogs and orange drinks and the bus back home for dinner. So as I became really interested in photography, I was wandering around downtown with a camera. So it's helped over the years a lot of buildings and places look familiar that I'd been in or knew where they were. And so as other folks have added stories to it, it's just built up some terrific memories, and you've met a lot of really interesting people. For a long while, it was just a question as to what's going to become of the collection. And when I got to talking with Brady and the folks at in Dayton History about it, it just seemed like this was the right spot. And I know that the folks here with Mary Oliver's guidance and all, they'll be sharing it with the public. And for those who have an interest in this kind of thing, that it'll continue to do its good work, if you will, well into the future.
Marvin Christian, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I spoke with Marvin Christian in the archive upstairs at Dayton History soon after he donated the Mayfield collection to them. Christian said he guesses old habits are hard to break. He still carries a camera in his pocket. If you're looking for more photographs of what Dayton is all about, we've got them for you at reinventionstories.org. Phase 2 of the website is now underway. Reinvention Stories is a multimedia storytelling project that asks the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? This week, an encore presentation of our story about Aronde Clark. Clark got into trouble as a young man in Troy, Ohio. After spending time in prison, he turned his life around, and with the help of Dayton's social programs, he started his own business, Clark's Enterprise. Reinvention Stories producers spoke with him at his home in South Park.
I come from the other side of the street. I've done a lot of dirt. I had a good, very good upbringing, brought up in the church, but chose to live in the streets and run the street life. And by the time I turned 18, I was headed to the penitentiary for aggravated felonious assault and numerous drug sales. And it was all bad. And I'm originally from Troy, Ohio, Miami County. And I'm the same guy that I was there, just they had no programs. No one reached out to help. When you at the rock bottom or when you get told no, you can't. That right there, how you respond to that whole you can't, how you respond to that defines you. Anyways, I went and did that little time. I did 3.5 years or 4 years at 19. Got out when I was like 20-some. And when I got out, I kind of dibble-dabbled, never been back to prison, but I kind of dibble-dabbled back in the streets because I didn't know how else to operate or to make ends meet. Didn't really even know another way to think. But thanks be to God, I started thinking different. I started wanting things different. My desires start changing, my motivation. Some people call it growing up and maturing. And I just really believe it was God giving me a hunger for something else. So time started to change with the depression. Seemed like all the chaos and the jobs, losing the jobs and all that just started to happen. While that was happening, I was being blessed. Work was just there for me. God just began to bless, and I wasn't making much, cutting grass, and was able to clean out houses. I knew we was going through a hard time, so I was willing, hey, I don't care how big your yard is, I'll cut it for $12, $13. If I could just get 100 yards for that much. And then I ran into Mr. Dalton, the public works supervisor in Trotwood, and he knew I was trying to run a business, and he just told me more or less quit playing with it and gave me some direction, and then led me to HRC, Human Relations Council, downtown Dayton. They helped me get what certification, what paperwork I needed, and I needed to be mentored. I needed that guidance, you know, and they gave me that and just helped me to get on my feet, you know. And one thing they didn't do was play with me. You know, they didn't tolerate no BS, no nothing. If this is what you want and this is what you're trying to do, we're here to help you. Miss Marcy Wright at the Human, God bless her. God bless her. I love her so much. She was the one told me that when you work, you get on your feet, you work, your business is flourishing, you're hiring people. This is helping the city. That's when I'm succeeding. When you're succeeding, this is what makes us all succeed. We do a lot of remodeling houses, from painting to drywall. You got a hole in the floor, replacing the floor tile. From residential to commercial to janitorial to construction, whatever it is you may need. And, you know, it didn't happen overnight, but it is possible, I know, because I'm living proof to make it through and make it through hard times, you know, if you just keep pushing. I love Dayton. Dayton has helped me, shaped me, helped mold me in more ways than one.
Since this interview, Clark has moved from South Park to Trotwood. He still operates Clark Enterprise, but he says business is slow. This reinvention story was produced by Chandra Jones, Steve Bognar, and Sarah Buckingham. To see a short film, visit WYSO.org. Reinvention Stories is brought to you by WYSO and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents and Radio, Incorporated, in collaboration with Ziga, with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Bill Felker with Borwell's Almanac for the transition time to middle spring. I have been bringing together all of my almanac notes for the past 35 years or so, and I try to separate myself from my observations, but that's becoming more and more difficult. It is becoming clearer to me that these notes are, well, they're autobiographical, even though they seem to have very little to do with me and everything to do with the trivia of what is happening at certain times throughout the small world in which I live. I'm finding that natural events, supposedly outside of me, are actually internal events. And I wonder if external reality, as Einstein asserted, if that reality is altered by observation, how much more is the observer's reality altered by observing? By the internalizing of external events. Well, anyone who stays in a house or a town or a relationship for an extended period of time undergoes this kind of change. Since both observer and observed subject and object are completely porous. Association over time permeates body and spirit. Certain pieces of land or a garden or furniture take on lives of their own inside the person who lives with them. They grow into the self, and they resist exorcism, and they persist in memory and emotion. And so the hundreds of thousands of words I have collected in my daybook for the year seep into me and out of me, and they are both the walk and the talk. I sometimes struggle with the banality of all of this. I want to see meaning in larger, maybe even in heroic terms, in pivotal decisions and wrenching or joyful life-changing events, not in old chairs or flashbacks or notes about the time a cardinal sang 23 years ago. Still, if I practice enough, sometimes I do know what to do with the big and the small. Sometimes things come together, and the pigments of the lesser objects and events flow and mix with the primary forces of momentous objects and events. And I can see for just a few seconds a purpose and a pattern in it all. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of middle spring. In the meantime, practice bringing things together, the big ones and the small ones.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.